We hope you find this WILL podcast to be valuable. A $10 voluntary credit card contribution at willpledge.org will help us continue to make podcasts of our programs available. Thank you. And that address again is willpledge.org. willpledge.org. Now here's your program.
Good morning and welcome to hour number two, Focus 580, our morning talk program. My name is David Inge, and we're glad to have you with us. The producers for the program, Harriet Williamson, Martha Deal, Jason Croft is at the controls. In this hour of Focus, we'll be talking about the care of companion animals, and we have two guests here with us, both from the University of Illinois College of Veterinary Medicine. They've both been on the program before, Julie Byron and Julia Whittington, both clinical assistant professors of veterinary medicine here at the U of I. Between the two of them, I think we can take on a whole range of questions about companion animals. Can be various kinds of illness maintenance questions. I'm sure we can talk about diet and nutrition. We can talk about a range of things, everything that deals with when the animals are young through their adolescence to the point where they get to be seniors. And of course, their needs and issues change over their life courses. Also, we can talk about wildlife and dealing with that, particularly from time to time. People say, well, they see wildlife in distress. What do I do about that? And we do have people at the vet school who are particularly experienced at dealing with wildlife, not just with kitties and puppies and horses and whatever else you got. So whatever it might be on your mind, call us, and I know that our two guests will do their best to help you out. 333-9455 and toll-free 800-222-9455. Well, thank you very much.
Thank you for having us. Glad to be here.
I don't know if there's anything real specific that we can talk about that has to do with winter and problems that relate to cold weather. I was just thinking about the fact that the dogs, particularly the dogs, got to go out. They've got to get exercise. We dress ourselves up and put on insulated boots and all that kind of stuff. But the dogs, well, some people do put stuff like that on their dogs. I'm not sure the dogs appreciate it. But anything that you might say, you know, generally about, well, dogs and cold weather and them having to be outside?
Well, I think that it's still – I think you make a very good point. It is still important to get them outside and get their exercise, not just for elimination purposes, but gets them outside, gets us outside. There are a few things to kind of keep in mind. A lot of times older dogs who may have some orthopedic problems may not have as good a footing on ice and snow, just like we have that problem. And so I think it's important to keep that in mind and try and keep them in areas where, you know, maybe there's a little less ice. I always clean out a fairly good size area in my backyard so that the dog can get out there without having to get too much ice under his feet, because my dog is quite old and has quite a few orthopedic problems. It helps eliminate him slipping and falling, that kind of thing. I also sort of, when I bring him back in, I check his toes real well. He gets these big chunks of ice between his toes. It's pretty uncomfortable. Just kind of clean him up a little bit. You know, as far as putting clothing on the dogs or warm clothing, I pretty much think a lot of it depends on the nature of the coat of the dog. If you have a fairly thin dog and has a thin coat or sparse hair coat, then I think it's perfectly acceptable, if the dog will tolerate it, to put some sort of wrap on them. You know, there's a whole variety of them available from a number of websites and pet stores and things like that, just to kind of give them a little extra warmth. Certainly there are those animals that won't tolerate it, but then there are those dogs, especially the Arctic breeds like Malamutes, who just – they love this kind of weather. This is the best
they were
time
made for
them. Exactly. Yeah. They were. I mean, this is what they were genetically bred for. They love it.
Anything else that you might want to say about – I'm also thinking about the pads on their feet and the fact that there's salt and other kinds of de-icing things that we put on the sidewalks.
You know, some of those de-icers are not just salt. And I don't know that salt itself causes so much of the issue. It's some of the other products that are de-icers. Some of them have ethylene glycol or propylene glycol in them as a melting agent. And, you know, those things can be toxic if ingested, if the dog cleans its feet. They can also be irritating to some dogs' feet and their pads. So, you know, I generally follow the rule of wiping my dog's feet off with a damp towel. It also helps with getting rid of that ice between the toes. When I bring them in after a walk outside in areas that have been de-iced, I think that some people like to use the little booties. I think those are fine. My dog absolutely won't tolerate them. But I think if, you know, that's another option as well.
Yeah. I don't know that I ever knew a dog that would. It's a terrible but sometimes hilarious thing because you put them on there and they say, no, what is this thing here? Get it off of me. Just one other reminder about antifreeze. You need to be really careful about that.
Absolutely. Antifreeze is exceedingly toxic to both dogs and cats, and it really doesn't take very much. A few licks can be very toxic. It causes acute renal failure, and unfortunately, the survival rate after the toxin is ingested is not very high unless you get them treated within just, you know, 4 or 5 hours of ingestion. If it's longer than that, unfortunately, the recovery rate is very poor, and it can be pretty devastating.
Okay. We have a couple of callers here. Let's talk with them. First up is someone in Salem, and that's line 4. Hello.
Hi. Thank you for your program. Mm-hmm. I have an 11-year-old corgi, and about a year ago, she started chewing on her back paw, and then she chewed on her other paw, and she chewed on her hip, and I've taken her to 2 different vets. They've given her cortisone. They've given her relaxing medicine, flea medicine. I've been doing nutritional yeast with her, and she's wearing a hood now, and I just can't. If I take the hood off and I'm not there, she'll chew. Do you have any reason for that?
Well, there are several reasons why dogs might chew on their feet or their backside, that kind of thing. And probably the most common one that we see that sounds like your veterinarians have sort of looked into is because they're itching, because they have allergies. And the most common things we see are allergies to fleas, food, and then the rest of the world, just like us. And cortisone, if it is an allergy, will temporarily improve the itching. Some dogs, it's not quite enough, and that might be why we always make sure they're on good year-round flea control, because even if they get even 1 or 2 fleas in the house, they'll survive through the winter, and sometimes we don't actually find them on them. So, I mean, I always recommend, and for my own pets, do flea control all year. Some dogs have a dietary allergy that manifests itself as a skin allergy, where they actually may be allergic to either something like wheat or beef or chicken or some product within the food. So sometimes trying a food elimination trial where they're put on a very specific type of food that only has 1 type of protein and 1 type of carbohydrate is another option, which means they can't really receive any treats or anything beyond that, unfortunately. But it oftentimes can make a major difference. And then if allergies are deemed not to be the problem, and really it has to be kind of ruled out by trying those things, some dogs will actually develop sort of an obsessive compulsive behavior where they will chew on one part of their body obsessively, and it kind of starts to release these endorphins, almost like people who may obsessively wash their hands or pick at their hair or things like that. And it sort of causes endorphin release, and it makes them feel good. And that's a behavior that needs to be broken using some very specific behavioral methods, giving them distractors. The anti-anxiety medication sometimes helps, things like that. And that might have been why your vet had suggested using a sort of maybe a relaxer if it was like an anti-anxiety medication, de-stressing kind of medication.
We've pretty much done all that and the diet and everything. I was wondering if, and we did do the Frontline and another type of flea thing, and a friend told me to try the oral flea pills. Do you recommend those?
It depends. I personally prefer the topical because what it does is it kills the fleas when they get on the dog. And if you have a dog or cat that has flea allergies, it only really takes 1 bite to set off that horrible itch cycle. And once they start itching, then they can get an infection in that area, and then that itches. And so you end up with this vicious cycle. So I actually prefer the topicals. I think there are some very good orals out there. I generally personally use them if I've got an animal who I've already got pretty decent flea control on already, as more of a kind of long term to keep the fleas in the household down, because what that really does is it affects the it's more of it retards the reproduction of the flea. So it reduces the number of new fleas that are born from the ones already in the environment. But unfortunately, it doesn't always kill them right away. Now, there is one called Capstar, which kills them very quickly. It's really kind of used intermittently. It's not a regular use medication, but if we have a patient come in that has a lot of fleas on them, we'll give them Capstar, and then the fleas are pretty much dead within about 2 hours. So,
well, we'll keep trying. She's 11 years old, never had any behavioral problems mm-hmm. or anything before. So.
And she's not having any other behavioral changes?
No.
Well, those are sort of the major things I would think about. And food trials, if you did do a food trial with a single source protein and single source carbohydrate, usually it can take up to 3 to 4 months of feeding only that food and nothing else
Yeah. We've done a food. Is there any brand that you would have in mind?
There are generally a few out there. There are several that pet food companies have designed specifically for patients with high allergy problems. Iams has one, Waltham, Hill's, Purina. They're usually products that you're going to have to find at your veterinary hospital. I do not believe there are any products that are specifically designed for allergy food trials that are sold over the counter. I think the majority are sold at veterinary hospitals. And it's not just things that are lamb and rice or things like that, because there's lamb and rice in a lot of pet foods. And so it's not actually considered a novel protein or novel carbohydrate anymore. I'm talking about things like rabbit or duck or kangaroo or, as protein sources.
Really? Okay.
Mm-hmm. So your vet should be able to give you a list of options. There's a lot of them out there, probably 8 or 9. So I would hope you would be able to find one your pet likes.
Okay, well, that's too bad about the kangaroo, but thank you very much.
All right, you're thanks welcome. For the call. Just to underscore something you said, I respect probably a lot of people don't, if they're fortunate that they seem to have flea control down pretty well, they probably don't think very much about fleas in the wintertime. They think about that, it's a summertime issue because the fleas are out there. They're out there in the world, and the dog goes outside and, gets in contact with the fleas. But is it your recommendation that people do that year-round?
I personally recommend it if they're, especially in some parts of the country, like in California, obviously, when they're not necessarily going to be frozen out, they have a huge flea problem out in California. Yeah. But even here, and I actually speak from personal experience, I have certainly found evidence of fleas on my pets during the winter. And what it is if they are brought into the house, they can get into the carpets and things like that. And they've got a ready food source because you've still got animals in the house. And, obviously they're not going to be picking them up from the environment so much. But personally, especially if you are aware that your pet has a flea allergy problem, I would absolutely continue with the front line through the winter months because it's always a potential. And I know a lot of people say, well, I don't see any fleas on my pet. I don't see any evidence of flea dirt, which is their feces, the little black specks you'll see in the fur. So they must not have fleas. Well, it only takes one bite to do it. And I think that if you have a low number of them, you may not see a lot of that evidence.
Okay. Our guest in this studio with us this morning, Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both clinical assistant professors of veterinary clinical medicine in the U of I Vet School. And we're talking about care of companion animals. And if you have a question about dog or cat, what have you, give us a call, 333-9455 and toll free 800-222-9455. A couple of champagne callers here. First is line one. Hello.
Hi. Mm-hmm. Yes. I am wondering if it is really worth getting a dog one of those coats things for the wintertime. I have a 6-year-old Australian shepherd whose coat is not as thick as his sister's. He's also an Aussie. And he just seems to get cold when we're out in the dog park, or am I fantasizing?
No, I think that if I think it kind of each individual person has to look at their pet and kind of assess their comfort level, and I think the owners are really the best people to do that. Certainly with dogs with thinner coats, greyhounds, some of the smaller breeds, I certainly support people who want to do that if the dog will tolerate it. If you feel like your dog is getting a little chilly, I think that it's certainly worth considering. There are some very good ones out there. I would heavily advise you to get one that is easily machine washable and isn't going to, get sort of pilled up and things like that. And in the wash, you want to get one that's easily washable and dryable because, of course, they're always going to be covered in something. Dogs love to roll in things, and
right.
Aussies are of no exception, I'm sure.
Mm-hmm.
But, yeah, and so, you know, some dogs don't take to them very readily, and if it's more stress on you and the dog to get the coat on him, you know, that certainly needs to be taken into account. But I think there are a number of different styles, and it doesn't have to necessarily even be that tight sweater we see some dogs wearing. There are some that almost look kind of like a horse blanket where it just sort of lays across their back, maybe
right.
hooks under their neck and under their belly. And
right.
those, I think, allows them a lot of freedom of movement. They don't feel like they're constricted, and yet they get a little bit of warmth. I think those are a really nice option.
I see. I've seen some that are completely fleece and go all the way around the dog. Do you know how those work or if they're any better than the ones that just lay across and have the strap underneath?
I think the ones that go all the way around probably may provide a little more warmth on their belly, and obviously that's what's up against the snow, that kind of thing. But I think a lot of it, the choice oftentimes has to do more with what your dog is going to tolerate and sort of your personal preference. I don't have any that I find work better than others. I personally prefer not to have a wool sweater on because it might be itchy, but I like the fleece ones. I think they look really nice. There are a lot of different styles. You know, they some of them might be a little more expensive. So there are some good online sources, I think, as well. I know a number of people that I work with have found some good online sources for them, too. So definitely, you know, look for them there as well as in pet stores.
Mm-hmm.
And it might be easier to size them online, too, to get they might have some instructions for how to measure on your dog to make sure you get the right size.
Okay, thank you.
All right, very good. To another caller here, line two. This is also Champagne. Hello.
Hello, thank you for taking my call. I'm calling about my miracle dog. He's an 18-year-old Brittany Spaniel, and he has some hearing, vision, and equilibrium problems, but he seems to be going through life without any pain, so we're, you know, we're just kind of keeping an eye on him. He's had a heart murmur for many years, but my problem with him is he it does a lot of pacing at night. He wakes up anywhere from 2 to 4 o'clock in the morning and just starts pacing and pacing. And because of his vision and equilibrium, he runs into things and smashes into doors and sometimes gets himself locked into a room when he gets behind the door and pushes it closed. Is there something you can suggest for the pacing?
It may be related as far as the causes. There is something called cognitive dysfunction that older dogs may experience. It's sort of what some people would refer to as, you know, my dog is like old and senile, things like that. And one of the things we definitely see in those dogs is pacing, anxiety at night, changes in their sleep-wake cycle, that kind of thing. And if his vision is diminished, it's likely that his vision in the dark is probably the poorest. And so he may be, you know, it doesn't surprise me that he's running into things. It can be very frustrating to deal with. Some dogs may have difficulty holding their urine through the night, so they might need to go out. Some may just be anxious. There are a number of different options that are available, things that you can do. You know, some people just go so far as sedating their dog before bedtime. I personally think that it's not a good idea to be sedating them every night. I think it sort of unless you kind of run out of other options. But if he would tolerate being confined to a fairly large crate, you don't have to have a small one that fits him exactly. You can certainly get one that's much larger where he can get up and turn around and that kind of thing, but sort of stays out of mischief. And you can put that in your bedroom where he knows you're there, or wherever, whatever room he normally sleeps in, with lots of comfy bedding and things like that. That might help confine him a little bit as far as running into things. There is some evidence that we can slow the progress of cognitive dysfunction in dogs. Some of it's things like using antioxidants, putting vitamin E in their food, using things like various antioxidant, you know, things that are available over the counter. There is also a medication that you may want to ask your veterinarian about. Called Selegiline or Anapril is the trade name. And there's some evidence it actually was approved for use in dogs with canine cognitive dysfunction syndrome, where it may slow the progress of the disease process, and some dogs actually will improve a little on it. And that it really is to improve their quality of life. And I congratulate you for doing whatever you're doing right and caring for your dog, that he's lived such a long life and is pain-free and pretty comfortable. I think that's a wonderful thing. But I, you know, it might be worth asking your vet about the Anapril, because I certainly have had clients who have used it and felt that it made a difference in their dog's pacing or anxiety or things like that, and maybe help them, keep them from getting lost in their own house and some of those other behaviors that can come along with it.
Thank you. That's so fascinating. I appreciate it. Do you know anything about any herbal supplements? I mean, you mentioned the antioxidants and the vitamin E. Are there other, like, herbal supplements you could use to...
Unfortunately, I am not particularly versed in non-Western veterinary medicine. However, mm-hmm. there are people who are. I don't know if there's anybody specifically in this immediate area who is. Your veterinarian may know if there is somebody who is, and some veterinarians kind of have a side interest in it, and they may be able to recommend something. I would probably try, if you want to try some herbal things, I would speak to a veterinarian who has some knowledge about it, because there are some herbal things that work in people that are toxic to animals. So I would there certainly are people who can be certified in alternative medicine in dogs and cats, and so that certainly is something you can think about. I personally, my own dog has some problems with cognitive dysfunction, and he wanders a bit at night, and so I've personally started just putting vitamin E in his food. And there are some foods that are sort of geriatric formulations, and a lot of those have additional antioxidants in them as well.
Yes, and he is on one of those. Do you know of a certain level that I should look for in the antioxidants and vitamin E?
I think one of the things is we haven't really identified where the most therapeutic level is. My guess is that if it's a reputable dog food from a major company, they've probably put the research in. I know Purina has done some research. Mm-hmm. I know Hill's has done research in determining, and Waltham as well, Royal Canin, determining the levels that they have in their foods. But as far as giving you a specific number, I don't feel that we have really a great number that says this amount is what you want to get to.
Okay, well, thank you very much.
You're very welcome. You. Good luck with him.
We are about midway through here this hour of Focus 580. We're talking about animal care, talking here at to start out certainly about care of companion animals. Our two guests are Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both clinical assistant professors of veterinary clinical medicine in U of I Vet School. And if you have questions, you can give us a call, 333-9455, and toll free 800-222-9455. Well, I want to ask Julia, because your focus is a little bit more on your exotics, not so much on puppies and kitties, but exotics and also wildlife. And I'm sure that that now probably maybe more than other times of the year, you get questions from people. They see a wild animal that seems to be in distress, possibly injured, and they say, well, what could I or should I do about that?
Absolutely. It's a tough time of year for everybody. our domestic animals and wildlife. We see a fair number of predator animals who run into trouble this time of year because simply their prey species are less abundant. Nobody's having kids right now in the wildlife world. And so they are going to take advantage of different situations where food is available, and whether that means that they're looking for some roadkill to imbibe on, or, you know, they're simply on the telephone pole by the side of the road waiting for that forlorn mouse to come by. You know, these animals are going to be susceptible to the hazards of the winter weather. We certainly see a rise of cases presenting to the wildlife clinic after storms come through. They can get disoriented. They can simply just get snowbound. And then they're going to be around when people can find them. So we encourage people, if they find an animal that seems to be in distress, whether it's injured or ill, to first of all consider their own safety. They should not approach an animal if they're not going to be equipped to handle it safely and prevent injury to themselves. But if they can collect that animal, we're happy to take it in the wildlife clinic and get it to the point where it can be released again.
Yeah. Well, when you say, you know, you don't want the people to get hurt, you don't want to hurt the animal further.
Correct.
How do you, how do you answer that question for yourself? Well, is this something that I can deal with and make sure that I'm not hurt and the animal's not hurt?
Mm-hmm. We get a lot of calls during the day, especially if out where we are at the vet school, we have a lot of rural roads, Windsor Road and Lincoln Avenue. A lot of red-tailed hawks and some of the other raptors sit along those roads, and they just take advantage of small prey that come by. So if you see an animal in the road and it's mantling, so it seems to not be flailing, it seems to be just standing there and it seems to be calm, kind of like you would expect to see maybe a parrot in a cage, upright, alert. Most likely that animal is feeding or otherwise healthy. But if the animal is in an abnormal position, laying down, flailing, drooping a wing, unable to fly away when approached, then that's an animal that's going to need some help. And certainly when we try to collect wild animals, it's important to have a container to secure them in. We've had a fair number of cases over the years where perhaps the animal, and opossums are notorious for this, look like they're injured on the side of the road. Somebody puts them in the back seat of their car, and by the time they get to us, they've got a pretty upset opossum in the back of their car. They need it extracted. So, certainly you want to confine it into a box or a carrier, something that you can have easy access to. And then instead of trying to physically restrain it, just simply scoop it into that container and bring it to us.
Yeah. And are there people in the vet school who have enough time on their hands so that you could, if someone called and said, look, here is this animal and I think that it's been hurt and here's where it is, can you actually or do you try to go out and collect it yourself?
Well, unfortunately, we don't have an ambulance service for wildlife, and our wildlife clinic is largely operated by our veterinary students. We faculty oversee them, but it's unusual that we can actually go collect an animal. That being said, we have some really excellent resources in our community. Animal Control, Urbana Animal Control, and Champaign County Animal Controls are usually quite helpful if they have the resources to go try to collect these animals. We work pretty extensively with all of our area police agencies to try to collect animals in need. And then we rely on the public to help us. If somebody has a question, maybe they're concerned about an animal, certainly they can call us and we can give them advice or resources that they can pursue to get help.
Okay. Other questions here, certainly welcome. Again, our number, 333-9455, and toll free, 800-222-9455. Here's a question for you. And I've been thinking about, in our house, we've been thinking about, we have a cat who lives with us. And he's been with us for a while. And a couple of times he's had symptoms that, and if you saw that in a person, you'd say, well, you have a cold. Now, the thing is that he is an indoor cat. He doesn't leave the house. He doesn't have contact with any other cats. So my question was, well, where's he going to get a cold from? And I guess the answer is, could he actually get a cold from us, from the people living in the house?
Well, not necessarily. Potentially, I suppose. It's not certainly outside of the realm of possibility, but the majority of the viral flus and things like that we see have not necessarily been identified as passing directly from a human to a dog, although or a cat, although there have been some recent reports of H1N1 being passed to domestic animals. But in general, the vast majority of cases, I feel, of cats, especially who develop, I'm assuming you mean something like an upper respiratory thing, sneezing,
right. Yeah.
That kind of thing, yeah. Sometimes a runny nose, runny eyes, that yeah. sort of thing. Mm-hmm. We see a lot of cats who have been exposed to one of several different types of viruses when they were younger or at some point. Oftentimes it's in a shelter situation. It may have been when they were newborn or in, under a year old. And they have acquired either something like a virus called Khaleesi virus or a particular type of herpes mm-hmm. virus, which is feline specific. And it actually can still be within their body, but sort of becomes dormant. And then during some periods of stress or other infection, bacterial infection or things like that can actually sort of rear its ugly head, and you can have a pet develop some respiratory signs. Those two particular viruses cause respiratory signs, nasal discharge, sneezing. They can cause eye irritation as well with Khaleesi virus. They can sometimes get little ulcers in their mouth. And unfortunately, there's nothing we can do to definitely rid the animal of the virus. We do vaccinate against these viruses. They are part of the sort of big combination vaccine that cats will get throughout their lives from their veterinarians. But vaccines are never 100%, and they're really, as far as protection, it's mainly will reduce the severity of the disease as if they become exposed or if they have sort of recrudescence of the disease when they've acquired it as a youngster. And certainly in some of the cases, they will develop a secondary bacterial infection that may require antibiotic therapy or additional care. And some cats in particular seem to have special problems with really getting severe enough infections that they stop eating. They need to be hospitalized until they're feeling better, potentially even hand-fed, things like that. But the majority of them, just like a cold in a person, are probably going to dissipate on their own. You know, general care of them, just making sure they're otherwise in pretty good shape, they're still eating and drinking. The majority of them will recover from the episode on their own. But unfortunately, it is something that some cats will battle throughout their lives.
Yeah. And now, since you mentioned it, I'm curious because, as you said, there had been some reports that H1N1 flu had been passed from person to
I honestly don't have the exact details in my head, so I don't think I can give you anything really specific. I believe the virus was isolated. I think it was one cat and one dog who had the virus isolated from them. And again, I don't feel like I can say definitive any details about it, but I don't think they were able to completely identify the source of the passage, but you know, we know that virus is out in the environment right now, and there certainly may have been some changes in the genetic makeup of the virus. But I wish I had more information than that. Mm, okay. I just don't. I apologize.
Yeah. And that brings up an important point. I mean, certainly different species of animals have their own viruses, and we know that certain influenza viruses affect certain species. They're species specific. But we also know that some influenza viruses can be shared. We know that avian influenza can go from birds to people. We know that some cats can get avian influenza. We know that ferrets can get different influenzas from their human owners. So I think that it's important for people to understand that viruses can be transmitted, and certain ones certainly are zoonotic or can go from animal to person or person to animal. So if we have a sick pet or we have a sick person, we need to really use good hygiene no matter what the situation.
All right. Let's talk with another caller. Here's someone in Atlanta, Illinois. Line 4 here. Hello.
Hello. Thanks for taking my call. I'll tell you where I live right now. It's in the tick capital of the world. So we took our two dogs, who both are on front line all year long, we took them to the vet for their annual checkup back in the middle of the summer. And he was finding, the vet was on one of the long-haired dogs, he was finding quite a few ticks that were dead. And he said, well, you know, your front line's really working. Look at the dead ticks here. And this particular dog runs loose periodically during the day. So he said, well, it looks like the front line's working fine. So I was sitting waiting to pay the bill, and he came running out, and he says, per our conversation, he says, both of your dogs have Lyme's disease. The heartworm test also had a marker on it for Lyme's disease. So he said, you know, we need to put them on doxycycline and clean them up. And maybe in January we ought to think about vaccinating them against the Lyme disease, even though they are on front line. So my question is, why didn't we do the vaccination then, which I should have asked him. We did have a lengthy conversation. I forgot to ask him instead of January. Now, as of the middle of December, I still, the inside house dog is taken on a leash every day, and she has big, really white patches of fur, and I have found dog ticks on her up till middle of December. So the chances of her being reinfected after the August treatment were there. Will he have to retest her then before he can give her the vaccination to see whether she has Lyme disease or not, or what is going on that I'm missing?
Well, and you bring this up. This is certainly a question that we get a fair amount from clients, from dog owners, and you brought up several really good points. The first is that it's another reason to have your pets on flea and tick control all year, because tick season is much different than flea season. We see them much more into the winter and the wet weather, where, you know, the fleas, when we get below a certain temperature, we're going to see a certain decrease in the number of them. The Lyme test, and I'm not sure exactly, there are several out there, the Lyme disease test, what that detects is the antibody, which is the body's response to the Lyme organism. And so many of the tests, if they're positive, it says that the animal has been exposed to Lyme disease. It doesn't necessarily say that they have active infection at that time. I'm not sure which test your vet may have been using, but it is oftentimes difficult to say, okay, they do have definite active infection now, and differentiate that from an animal that's simply been exposed. Now, certainly in an area of high tick prevalence, any tick control is going to be helpful, but is certainly not going to eliminate the possibility of them getting ticks, as you have found. Some people will add a prevent tick collar, which also can help reduce the number of ticks on top of the front line. It's especially a chemical impregnated collar if they feel comfortable using those on their pets. But as far as preventing their exposure to ticks, it sounds like you're already well aware you're in an area that you may not have that much of that much success more than what you're doing. And dogs in high tick areas, certainly if Lyme disease is in the area, which it is around here, they absolutely will be exposed to it. And there are areas of the country where most dogs are positive. Now, does that mean they have Lyme disease? It means they were exposed to it and their body has had a reaction to it and has done what it's supposed to do, which is produce antibodies against the organism. If your dog does not have any clinical signs of Lyme disease, swollen joints, lethargy, weakness, things like that, then your dog may not actually have active disease, but it can be very difficult to determine. So a lot of people, as a precaution, especially in high tick areas, may go ahead and put their patients on doxycycline. It's a relatively inexpensive drug. It's well tolerated by a lot of animals, and it's sort of more of a precautionary situation. And so I certainly understand why your veterinarian did that, especially if their reactions were very positive on the test that he did. Now, as far as vaccinating them, the difficulty with the Lyme vaccine is there's a lot of controversy over how effective it really is. One of the problems is that if you vaccinate an animal against Lyme disease who has never been exposed to the disease, they may end up with a positive test, because the vaccine induces an antibody response, which is part of the way vaccines work to help the body fight the disease, so that if the animal is exposed to that disease, the body's already sort of primed and ready to react right away. In a lot of the tests for Lyme disease, unfortunately, cannot distinguish between the vaccine and the body's reaction to the actual organism. I believe there are a couple out there that are much better at doing that. As far as why your vet may have wanted to wait, it may have been that they wanted to wait until after the doxycycline treatment was over. It may have been if there were other issues with your pets. We always want to make sure our pets are as healthy as possible when we do vaccinate them. But as far as specific reasons, I'm not sure. I can't think of anything very specific, but it may be that they wanted to make sure that the doxycycline trial was over. And whether or not your vet retests them for Lyme disease ahead of time, sometimes those antibodies can take months to go away after the animal's been exposed. Especially if they get re-exposed to ticks, then they're going to continue to have antibodies to that. So it can be very difficult to interpret those things sometimes.
So that you really, really are helping, and great information. And the question is, if they go ahead and give the vaccination, will that hurt anything or not hurt anything dependent on the antibodies that are there?
It shouldn't cause them a problem. It's a pretty safe vaccine. I don't believe there have been a lot of problems with the vaccine. It's not used that often in areas where there's not a high prevalence of Lyme disease because of the problem with it interfering with some of the tests. But like I said, now I believe there are some newer tests on the market that can distinguish between the vaccine antibodies and the actual natural exposure antibodies. I believe it's a safe vaccine. I don't think you should have any real concerns. If your vet doesn't know anything about your pets that brings any concerns to his mind, I would expect that it's a safe vaccine to give.
Well, thank you very much. Thanks.
Sure.
All right. Very good. Thank you. About 10 minutes, a little bit more left in this part of Focus 580. And our guests are Julie Byron and Julia Whittington. They're both clinical assistant professors of veterinary clinical medicine, U of I Vet School. And if you have questions about companion animals, we can do that. Also, Julia, her particular interest is wildlife. So wildlife questions, we can do that too. Any and all of that, they'll do their best to help you out. 333-9455 here in Champaign-Urbana. Toll free, 800-222-9455. And email will-talk@illinois.edu. Next is someone in Wellington. Line one, hello.
Yes, we have a cat that's going on 12 years old. It's an indoor-outdoor, my husband's shop cat, and it developed diabetes. And when I took it in to the vet, they told me that diabetes in cats is a lot more easily regulated by diet alone than it is in dogs and humans. And we started on some very high-protein cat food, and it, in a week's time, it's like a different animal. It really perked up and what have you. My biggest difficulty is buying this particular kind of cat food in our area, but I wanted to know about some other things, like, for instance, in humans, I know it's very regular that they be fed at eat at a certain time, that sort of thing. So I'm wanting to know what other things we can do to kind of, go along with this diagnosis.
Well, diabetes in cats, there is a fair amount of evidence out there that putting them on a lower protein diet or a higher protein diet, rather, and a lower carbohydrate diet can do several beneficial things. One of them is helps reduce some of their weight problems. Weight certainly is associated with diabetes in cats. Getting some weight off of them is very important. In addition, there is evidence that you can get cats actually off of their insulin or drastically reduce their insulin needs by putting them on the people call it a Catkins diet because it's high protein, low carb, like Atkins diet. And there are a couple of brands out on the market I know of, and something that might be able to help you find it a little easier is if your vet can either special order it for you, because most of them are veterinary distributed products, or can have a prescription written for you where you can order it online. There are several online places you can get it. Feeding them at a regular time, I think if your pet is on insulin, if the cat's on insulin, I think it is fairly important to try and keep things pretty regular from day to day. I usually tell clients if they can kind of keep their feeding and insulin times within an hour or two on either direction. So if you have an animal who normally gets its insulin at 8 a.m. and 8 p.m., any time between, say, 7 and 9 is, pretty good to try and aim for. Certainly, we cannot always abide by those exact things. Life gets in the way sometimes, even for our own medications. But if you can keep it pretty close together, especially if your animal's on insulin, to make sure that they eat some before you actually give the insulin. It's kind of tough if you give the insulin and then they don't go and eat their meal because they're not feeling well, and now you've given insulin. Unfortunately, it can drop their blood sugar more than normal, potentially. But I think that if you keep the amount fed and approximate time of day that you feed them pretty consistent, I think that's a really good thing. I would try to keep their activity level up. That also helps minimize insulin needs. Cats are so difficult. You try and play with them and they sort of lay there and look at you like you're crazy. But some of them can be induced to play more, get some more exercise, that kind of thing, and try to minimize things like treats and stuff that might increase their weight. You want to try and make sure you're feeding them the right amount to keep their weight down, that kind of thing.
Okay, this cat is not on insulin. I'm feeding it something called Wellness.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess it's more of an East Coast brand or something.
I believe so. I agree. I haven't really seen a lot of that around here. The brands that I particularly recommend are Royal Canin, I believe, has one, has a higher protein diet. Purina has one. I believe Hills has one as well. Those are the ones that I have used. But, you know, some people even will use kitten food, which is higher protein, lower carb. And actually, until the pet food companies developed these higher protein foods, especially for cats with this problem, that was what we sort of did, was we put them on kitten food. Now the pet food industry has really jumped in and created some nicely formulated diets to help us in these cases. Now, and you can feed those diets to any cat, whether they are diabetic or not. It definitely will help keep the weight down on some cats that tend to gain weight quite a bit and may reduce their potential for developing diabetes, as well as ease their joints and things like that. I'm glad to hear your cat doesn't need insulin right now.
One other quick question. What is a normal glucose level for a cat?
It depends. Our normal range usually runs between 60 to maybe 160 or 180. Now, the difficulty is cats have a very acute stress response, and so they actually, their blood sugar can spike up quite high just in the struggle of restraining a cat to draw a blood sample. Some cats are more stressed out by the procedure than others. Some cats may be completely fine with holding still for a few moments and having a blood sample taken. So a mild increase in their glucose level up to the high 100s or even low 200s absolutely has been seen. Some people call it the, quote, white coat effect. Just the act of putting them in a carrier, driving them in a car, letting them out at the vet hospital, being examined, those kinds of things can be enough stress to put them pretty high. There are some other tests that we can do that have a better idea, not just a spot glucose, but there's something called a fructosamine level, which sort of gives us an idea of what the cat's average glucose has been over the last several weeks. And if that's elevated, that gives a little more credence to the fact that their glucose may be running on the high side, as opposed to an animal who just had an immediate stress response because of the stress of going into the veterinarian.
Thank you very much.
Okay,
you're very thank you. To McLean County for another caller here. Line 2, hello.
Hi. I noticed my llama coughing this morning, half an hour ago. I haven't had a chance to do some research and see if I should be worried about that. Should I be taking my llama to the vet if I notice coughing? Is that a problem?
Well, I'm not a llama vet, so I'm gonna just talk in generalities here. But I would say that certainly animals cough occasionally, and when the weather is cold and the humidity is down, they can get dry throats. So certainly making sure that a fresh, non-frozen water source is available and good quality feed is available. That being said, if your llama has a change in appetite, if they're not consuming water as they normally do, or if the cough is persistent, then definitely I would take your llama to the vet.
Okay. And a quick second question. When I tuned in, I heard you mention the wildlife clinic.
Yes.
Is that somewhere we can take injured animals, injured wildlife, and if so, what charges are applied?
Well, that's a really good question. I'm glad you brought it up. The Wildlife Medical Clinic certainly is open to anybody who wants to bring us any injured or ill wild animal. What we cannot take are escaped exotic pets. So occasionally we will get in something like, a savanna monitor, and that's not native to North America, but any native North American species we can take. There is no charge to you. The Wildlife Clinic is completely run on donations and fundraising. So certainly if you would love to make a donation to us, we will accept it gratefully and apply it to caring for our patients. We see about 1,500 animals a year, but we are open 24 hours a day, 7 days a week, located in the small animal clinic at the Veterinary Teaching Hospital, and just bring patients on by.
Okay, great. Thank you.
All right. Thank you for the call. I assume that's some kind of reptile
The Savannah monitor.
Yes. This time of year, occasionally we get reptiles who've escaped from their enclosures or been released, so to speak, and they'll seek heat, and they'll be found in car engines and things like that.
Woo. Okay. Well, let's see. We've got one more here. We'll talk with someone here in Champaign County, line three. Hello.
Hi. I'm not a part of this group, and I don't know much about them, but I know there's a benefit for a group called CatSnap, Champaign Area Trap, Spray, Neuter, and Adoption Program or something like that, and seems like a worthy thing. They're particularly talking about feral cats, cats that have been abandoned or outside in very cold weather, and it's like the 30th of this month and in Urbana, and people can, it's a long enough time people can look for that in advance, I guess, and find out about it. I don't know if it's good to just say it all and promote the well, it's at the Iron Post in Urbana the 30th of January. I guess that's okay. Thanks a lot.
Okay. Yeah, sure. Is this something that you know about?
I in particular have not been involved in CatSnap. However, they do have a fairly large presence in Champaign County. In fact, I know a number of our students volunteer with them to run spay days. They sponsor spay days to encourage local community members to spay their and neuter their cats. They also do the trap, neuter, and adopt, or TNA. There's also TNR, trap, neuter, release, that goes on. And they do have a very active adoption service that I believe sometimes runs at various pet stores and things like that. My understanding is they're a very reputable group, and I appreciate knowing about the benefit.
Yeah, okay. I guess the big thing, particularly the concern, is that what feral cats or cats that are out there in the wild, you at the very least, you would hope that they would not be reproducing, adding to the problem. And then also, if you know, depending on the cat's condition, I suppose, it would be a nice thing to get them off the streets and get them into some place where they'll be taken care of.
Right. And to get them, and they usually do vaccines, I believe, and deworm them and, you know, do several other things. And I believe they tag them so that we know who's been neutered already or spayed. And, you know, it's CatSnap is an organization that's very similar to a lot of them all over the country. And those, they really do rely a lot on volunteerism and donations to try to reduce the feral pet population.
Okay. Well, I guess we're just about the point we have to finish up. One thing I certainly would mention that on your website for the vet school, there's a lot of information there on animal care. So it's possible that if people have kind of routine questions, they might be able to find an answer there. They can look at a very long list of issues that apply to cats and dogs. If people have questions...
Absolutely. Our college has a really active outreach program, and if people have questions pertaining to their pets or wildlife or any animal, they can contact us through our website, and the information will be passed on to the appropriate faculty, and we'll be happy to answer any questions
okay.
there.
And do you do vet care? I mean, if you wanted to, could the U of I Vet School be your vet?
Absolutely. We have a primary care service for both exotic pets and for small animal pets. We also have a very active large animal program. So we provide primary care service as well as referral and specialty services. And we're happy to talk to anybody.
All right. Our guests this morning, Julia Whittington and Julie Byron. They're both clinical assistant professors of veterinary clinical medicine at U of I, the vet school. Thanks very much for being here.
Thank you.
Appreciate it.